Okay, so I'm trying to give a Lutheran perspective, and we'll actually spend a bit more time than our opening comments, something like on Luther himself and how he frames this, and then go to how Dietrich Bonhoeffer tries to move it after modernity, as if Luther is just on the edge of, you know, medieval and modern thought. And so obviously there's lots of issues that he didn't have to deal with that modernity deals with. So then moving it into the 20th century, I will use a bit of Dietrich Bonhoeffer to show how the private, the public, and the secular are framed for him. And then if time permits, touch a tiny bit on one of our Augustana distinguished guest lecturers that we had a few years back, Cynthia Morlovida, who is a Lutheran trying to say, well, what would Luther's framework have to do for the 21st century, right? So you may not get there, but you can ask about it. and it's also true, before we actually start, that many Lutherans, so rather than Luther or Bonhoeffer or Cynthia Morlovida, actually accept this modern division between private and public. You know, and as Bill was mentioning in the introduction, I mean, the typical modern split is the public is the realm of, you know, facts and evidence-based decision-making, at least that's what they tell us. I don't see much evidence-based. You just suppress most of the evidence, and then you have evidence-based decision-making in the public realm. But supposedly, right, that's sort of this objective, value-free realm. And then in the private realm, you have your taste for wine or lack of your taste for wine. You have your values. You have your religious beliefs. They're all lumped together, right, into this private realm. And of course, the private shouldn't influence it, or your religion, your tastes, etc., should not. Your personal opinions should not influence the public. The public, you have to be rational, objective, etc., etc. So that's the modern division that is serving somebody very well, but not society. Luther is before this version of life actually, it was just starting to happen. But I think his framework is still probably interesting for us to look at, exactly because he simply does not separate private from public. I mean, those are not categories that he works with. He doesn't even separate sacred from secular in a certain way. What he does, instead, he looks at humans, echoing what, of course, the Calvinist tradition has picked up, in terms of inner and outer persons, and looking at the world and work as God's address to us. And that's, so it's in the world where we then also have to respond to God, and constantly are, either in accepting or rejecting what the address of reality is giving to us. And so we can use the phrase, William Lazarus coined it in one of the introductions to Church and Society volumes of Luther's endless works. I mean, of course it's cheating. I mean, you know, he would have gotten tenure so quickly because his students just copied all his stuff down. He didn't have time often to write the stuff down. And then it just got published as Luther's stuff, right? I mean, so, anyhow. So, I should have my students, they don't even know how to write this. It's because I speak so clearly, I think that's why they can't quite do it. Anyhow, but William Lazarus uses the phrase in one of these, I think volume 45, sacred secularity. Okay, so that would to capture Luther's understanding. And it's, so this world is sacred secularity, but it's also the place where the evil one tries to divert us from fulfilling our calling to serve others. So it's both a place of conflict in a certain sense, but it is also the primary place where we are called to respond. So I will do it from a theological perspective, then an anthropological perspective, sort of, if you want, quote the Godward sign, put it in quotes, because Luther would put it in quotes, and then from the human anthropological side, how he unfolds this. So two metaphors, which I still like. Some of you have heard them before. But for Luther, we never have access to the naked God. You know, God as God is in it whatever self, you know, we don't even know what pronoun to use, is beyond human reach. You cannot reach God, the transcendent, by human reason, because we're limited in time and space, aside from the fact that, at least in the Christian tradition, and I think it's democratically distributed, we're sinful human beings. With other words, that we turn away from God also would block our capacity. But just even reason, right, is limited in time and space. We're humans. So there's no way we can reach, quote, the naked God or the aseity of God or all this fancy theological language. But because we cannot read God either that way nor through emotion, emotion is still a human thing, and so it would still be a very creaturely thing, even if you have deep emotions or whatever, or high emotions, it's still a creaturely phenomenon. And so people say, well, I have had this experience of God. You say, okay, well, because people have justified with their, quote, experiences of God all sorts of horrific things in the world as well. Luther would say, well, that's just trying to climb up into the heaven on ladders. And ultimately you will fall, and often fall into despair. But at the same time, he would say, but God is, you know, and again, then you almost have to put God in quotes because he hasn't defined God, but God is present, closed in creation. Right, so that's a key notion for him, which means a few things. It means, on the one hand, we're not talking just about nature. It's nature and society. Right, so what some people call reality in postmodernism, we often can't even use the word reality anymore. But the real world of people, human communities, society, nature, is all the closed presence of God. So Luther would say then that God addresses you through the various people in their various roles or through nature. And so the question is that, maybe the comment is, just to shift his language a bit, why is God closed in creation? He would say, well, because God faces you or God addresses you. It isn't that when you scientifically go through nature, you'll come up with the God factor, right? If they're doing the brain analysis or whatever, you know, and okay, is there a God center or something where, if you stimulate that, people have sort of religious feelings. Well, for Luther, that would be totally irrelevant, right? You're not trying to find the God factor because the world can address you. You can be called, right, through the realities of life to go into action, to respond. That is, if you want, the presence of the divine. Another image, though, is God's commands are written into life. He would also say, you don't need a university professor, just consult your own heart. Right? And that's why, you know, they sort of cut religious studies faculties to say, you don't need faculty. You know, consult your own heart, and it would tell you that you should love your neighbor as yourself. I think a lot of people aren't listening to their heart very well. But anyhow, so the point for Luther, then, at this stage, is we encounter God in our worldly, that's a modern term, right? But in our life, in the world, let's put it that way. So I'm sorry this is not gender neutral necessarily, but Kjell Ove Nielsen, Scandinavians usually write in German, so they're published. So das Miteinander des Göttlichen und Menschlichen. So the togetherness of the divine and human is the his book. And he writes, God's commands are active in all orders and stations, in all other things and circumstances, and thereby human existence is totally shaped and ruled by God every moment. So the important implication here is, therefore, there is no separate religious realm isolated from a secular realm of social, political, ecological, economic, cultural, family roles and responsibilities. Right, because your whole life, from the moment you woke up, is being shaped because you do not have control. You are a limited creature. You do not give time. Right? What time gives comes in from the outside. You don't know which student is going to knock at your door and what the challenges are you're going to face that day or whatever else is happening. So that is this intention that we're constantly ruled by God every moment. It doesn't mean we acknowledge it. Right? It doesn't mean we're even consciously aware of it. God is also clothed in the word. And so it's, again, it's a human, limited, creaturely presence, because we as humans cannot transcend time and space. So God is clothed in the word, and for Luther that means an intentional revelatory word that reveals to the human heart that the mystery of life means humans well. That would be the essence of that clothed in the word. And as a result, humans can trust that what daily life brings them, and it could bring them joy, it can bring them suffering, it can bring them grief, that none of that can ultimately separate them from God's love. Right? So even if you have extreme illness, that cannot destroy ultimately the human spirit or God's spirit connecting to you. So that is trust which the word gives you. And of course, for him, the word is close presence, very clearly the word made flesh and living among us. Now, the key function of the word is to address the inner person, similar as in the Calvinist tradition. And by addressing us in the inner person, we become able to respond. And so here's a little phrase from, if you want, Luther's thought. So when the word frames our concrete reality, so word is like story. It frames how we view the world. Then this world becomes of spiritual use to us. Luther was fluent in Spanish, and so he would say, si se calla el cantor, calla la vida. If the singer falls silent, life itself falls silent. So the word's function is to make of spiritual use what you are concretely experiencing in your daily realities. And let's go now from the human perspective, the anthropological side. For Luther, humans are social creatures. Which means, and here's a quote, in the earthly realm, humans always stand in relazione, always bound to another. So humans are never autonomous selves. You can't be a private individual who occasionally relates to the public realm, because our relationships are part of our being. We all depended on humans to be born, and we are to nurture and to grow up and to learn language. All of these things, we're always in relationship. That is part of human nature. So the modernity of the autonomous individual is an abstraction. We can function as if, forgetting all the impact that our life always has on others and how others have always impacted us. So in Luther's language is, you know, the social positions, the stations, but he, and some of that language is gone, but he would also call it, these are all your callings, all your role relationships to others are your calling. And so in a typical, this is Gustav Wingren on, it's called Luther on Vocation, which one of my editors once wrote wrong and said Luther on Vacation. When Luther was in Hawaii, this is what he said. And again, this is not gender-inclusive language. The same man is father of his children, husband of his wife, master of his servants, and office holder in the town hall. We could say, well, employer or employee, citizen of our city, of our province, of our country, we're global citizens because we're so interconnected economically, at least. It's the same person. So we are called to serve in all these relationships. So the private public distinction would be artificial and is only possible if we ignore our interconnected relational realities. I've got all of these turned the wrong way around. Isn't that nice? Little aside, I never do asides. David was mentioning that I'm so bound to text. John gave a brilliant paper. Has it been published, this Hypnotized by Progress?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Well, we read it in a draft version and shared it with all our students. But the amount of ecological damage we can do is only when we see ourselves as isolated from nature and from the human communities that have nurtured us. Right? Then we think we're somehow above the world, and then we can make all these fairly idiotic decisions. And part of it is because all of a sudden this isolated individual believes or is hypnotized by progress. Right? I mean, that's a little...
Yes? Repeat the beautiful sentence that you just said. It just makes perfect sense.
Well, when the humans isolate themselves and lift themselves away from the nature and human communities, which we are all connected to, then we can make such stupid, ecologically destructive decisions economically because we're hypnotized by progress. something like that, right? I can't remember myself. Like, I can't even read my own notes on the blackboard a second after I wrote them. So, I rely on my students. Where was I? Okay. But this social relational nature does not mean that we are not also have an individual personality, which is different from being an isolated individual. And our individual personhood means basically we have responsible selves. Okay, and in Luther's language then is we are not just outer persons, like relational beings in multiple roles. We also have an inner self or a heart or a core of our being, our core of our personhood. But the heart also, or the inner self, is not an autonomous entity. That you can't objectify yourself. You can't, through introspection, sort of find, now I found myself. Or my students, after they graduate, they travel to Australia or whatever, they're going to find themselves somewhere. probably in the outback. Luther would say you could save the money. You can't get there this way because your inner self is a relationship. It is what you devote your heart to give you sense and meaning and worth and all of these kind of things, right? And so he would say, basically, we basically have two options. We choose something in creation, including some human-created idea, and we can devote ourselves, it could be a very good idea, and devote ourselves to that. But because it's a created and limited idea, it will always become idolatrous, and as soon as you devote yourself to something idolatrous, like the dream of progress, right, then you will become destructive, naturally, because it's only something limited that you've absolutized, right? So that we devote ourselves either to some created idea or to God who stands within, behind all of our created life and time, meaning again that we don't have access, like we cannot objectify this God either, right? That means we acknowledge our limitedness by acknowledging we trust the transcendent source of all of life, or the mystery of life, or however you want to put it. So in Luther's phrase, basically, is what your heart relies on becomes your God. And so that necessarily guides your feelings. Like, because if you're devoted to this, and something's going to happen negatively to your class power and your capital accumulation, you'll feel very badly. And other people could say, that's actually really good. Maybe finally the workers can be heard and the people who are being exploited around the world can be heard again. So they could feel very happy that maybe an economic crisis happens. So depending on what you're devoted to, your feelings will be different. But then how you view the situation obviously is different. And therefore your decisions and actions will be different. Right? In all the areas of life that you are involved in. So the key thing for Luther then is the devotion of the heart or the inwardness, which is what the only thing that distinguishes the person who trusts a well-meaning God and anybody who doesn't. Luther puts it this way, referring to Christians in this case, externally there is not much difference between the Christians and other socially upright human beings. Christian, and again masculine language, he does his duty according to his calling. He rules the commonwealth, he runs the household, he tills the field, he helps, supports, and serves his neighbor. However, he would say there's an inner difference. And in the various tasks are done, and this is a quote, in faith, in the joyful spirit, obedience, and gratitude to God. So, if you do things in the spirit of obedience and gratitude to God, of course, differences also will appear. The key difference would be you can't approach a situation ideologically. Right? You cannot absolutize any human construction, any social, economic, political system. And because of that, you probably should have a greater freedom to actually name the realities of what is going on. So differences will appear. So in short, what faith contributes to the civil life, as it does to life in all our relationships, is not a new ideology that is thinking to be better than other ideologies. So now we have a Christian ideology which competes, let's say, with a Marxist ideology or a Muslim ideology or whatever. That's not the issue, no. It's not competing ideologies at all. It contributes freedom. For Luther, that's the key thing. What the Christian faith contributes is freedom, and freedom means the freedom from self, the freedom to be truly responsive, and therefore the freedom to be there for others. Right? So it's not the individualistic freedom, I can do whatever I want, freedom is power. Right? I have the power to do what I want. It's the freedom to be there for others. That's what the faith is to provide. And so his very folksy example, he says, when a husband and wife really love one another and thoroughly believe in their love, who teaches them how to behave one to another, what they are to do or not to do, say or not to say, what they are to think? Confidence alone teaches them all this and even more than necessary. So confidence is your teacher. Trust is your teacher. Faith is your teacher. And now what faith or trust does, it allows you to, and that's such an overused word, but Luther plays with it a lot. But obviously it allows you to love, but again, love can be sentimentalized, reduced, all sorts of weird things. For Luther, the essence of love is free activity, non-prescribed activity. Even the church cannot, which he tried at his time, right? The church tried to prescribe, these are the good actions that you're supposed to do. You know, and he says, no, ultimately, all of our life is supposed to be a good work rather than certain prescribed good works. Like, why should a pilgrimage to Rome be good if you're abandoning your kids at home? Right? There weren't even any nannies you could hire. So, whatever. So, right? So, for him, that is artificial. No, all of life has to be a good work. You're eating, you're walking, your whatever activities you're doing, your civil life, all of your engagements has to be a good work. And it can only be a good work if you are free, freed from ideology, self-preoccupation, and free to be there for the network of people that you are connected to. So, this is all basically as if the fall didn't exist. Right? Actually, basically, all of this would happen even if there weren't a thing, you know, that theologically is called the fall, or that humans are tend to curb in on themselves or separate, alienate themselves from God and another. So, Luther would say, if sin didn't exist and humans lived as they were created to be by faith in God and love to their neighbor, we would not need laws or temporal government, since everyone would serve their neighbor and seek their welfare of their community of their own accord. But he would comment, but we still need God clothed in the Word. We still need story, we still need narrative, we still need something to feed our human heart, to call us to trust and obedience. So Word is still important. So he would say, yeah, Adam and Eve would have already lived by the Word, and you shall not eat from this clump of trees was, for him, Word. It limits humans, and at the same time, it says you can trust. Right? So that's crucial for him. Luther said even when Christendom, and we saw the sort of demise of Islamicdom, I don't know the good, the correct language, you know, in Turkey, or the challenge of that. And so here we're at the edge of Christendom. It's still around for a while in the West, right? But it's starting to shift a tiny bit in terms of as a unified bloc. But he says, even when Christendom was at its height, and most people were baptized Christians in Germany. He says there are very few real Christians. Right? So everybody's baptized Christian, everybody, you know, goes to church or doesn't stay in the pub while the wives go to church, you know, and then whatever, then you might go into the final moments of the Mass or something. So, but even in that situation, he says very few people are real Christians, meaning very few really live by faith in God and love of neighbor. That would be the test of whether they were, quote, real Christians. So then what do we do with humans that tend to are alienated from one another and from God? And he says, well, we do have and we do need, on the one hand, temporal authorities. With other words, how do you restrain people? Right? And so this is the role of worldly or secular authorities, is to create peace, restrain evil and wickedness, in Luther's language, by laws and the power of the sword, which basically means the state always has coercive power. it can enforce its laws, right, in many ways. So that's the one hand. That's the limit of what the state can do. It can, if it's any good, it restrains evil rather than promoting exploitative practices, whatever, right? And it can restrain wickedness, it can theoretically jail people, but it can use jail simply as a holding tank for not dealing with social problems, right? So it, that's not what Luther means. It means it's there to maintain or preserve creaturely life in human communities. That's the role of the state. But he says, at the same time, there's a spiritual regimen that's also instituted. And this temporal regimen, the spiritual regimen, has already at the time of Lutheran confessions, and I won't go through the history, pretty quickly gotten frozen into two kingdoms. So a lot of people always think Luther teaches about two kingdoms, and that one's autonomous, can do its own thing, and that one can do its thing. No, he actually, God rules, and Bonhoeffer will see, picks that up again, God rules basically both through temporal and spiritual regimen, but each one has a different function. So the spiritual regimen rules the inner self, very similar to what John was talking about, and it rules the inner self, no coercion. All you have is story, all you have is word, and the power of the spirit. That's it, when the word speaks to you, right? That's the power of the spirit, and that's all it has. And Luther said, well, you know, you know, the emperor and the pope, everybody tries to use all sorts of temporal power, right? I've written my words and then I go to sleep and my word does the work. So he felt the Reformation was not a coercive thing. Of course, he's ignoring that some of the princes then got into the battle and had also political and geographic and other agendas, right? But ultimately, he says, ultimately, no, it's the word that should bring about that kind of change. Right, on the inner self, again, you know, whether it's your conscience or whatever, but it's, he's dealing more with your devotion. What is your heart connected to? That has to, can only happen through the spiritual regimen. Okay, in his tract, Intemporal Authority, to what extent it should be obeyed, he shows why Christians would be involved with temporal government. And again, notice a true Christian by him means not having the right beliefs, but somebody who lives by trusting God and obedience. So, since a true Christian lives and labors on earth not for himself alone, but for his neighbor, he does by the very nature of his spirit even what he himself has no need of, but is needful and useful to his neighbor. Because the sword, so the state's ability to enforce, is most beneficial and necessary for the whole world, in order to preserve peace, punish sin, and restrain the wicked, the Christian submits most willingly to the rule of the sword, pays taxes, honors those in authority, serves, helps, does all he can to assist the governing authority, that he may continue to function and be held in honor and fear. Just as he performs all other works of love, which he himself does not need, so he serves the governing authority, not because he needs it, but for the sake of others, that they may be protected and that the wicked may not become worse. If he did not so serve, he would be acting not as a Christian, but even contrary to love. So by serving or obeying the law, he means that Christians have the right to actively take part in temporal regimen. You can be a judge, you can be a jailer, you can be an office holder in the town. All of those are possibilities. However, contrast to some later Lutherans' understandings, the temporal authorities are always limited. And Christians always have to obey God rather than humans. And so when one cannot obey the given law of a government or the action of governing authorities in good conscience, Luther encourages civil disobedience. The first civil disobedience in the large catechism is for children. If parents raise you in a worldly way, that you're only concerned about your pleasure and career advancement, you should in no way obey them. That's an interesting version, isn't it? Civil disobedience, more like, say, nurses, is for him a passive and non-violent resistance to the actions of governing authorities or people who have power. So, in fact, Luther exemplifies there is a limit to the scope of governing authorities. They have a very limited task,
restrain evil, keep peace, and you have to limit governing authorities by not allowing them to try to dictate, you know, what the inner person should do. In other words, certain dukes were saying you can't read these books, et cetera, and Luther already said, no, they are overstepping their mandate when they do that. Okay, let's jump to, so the weapons, again, of the spiritual regiment is the word and nothing else. Perfect. In the contemporary, we'll jump to Bonhoeffer, because Lutherans, two regiments, again, had become virtually independent spheres of existence. And so people moved from the realm of the church, right, and it did its thing, and then you moved over to the state, and then you said, well, the state dictates, right, I mean, after all, they're the governing authorities, and I didn't sound use sort of the notion of the natural orders of creation, very dangerous language during Nazism. That's why, you know, we have to be very highly conscious of how that can be misused. Luther did talk about roles and orders, and that, yes, your roles are mandates by God, but he did never institutionalize this particular form of government is divinely sanctioned. No, it's just a human creature. It's a human creation for a particular function. And so because of that, people lived in ethical conflict a lot, right? I mean, I'm doing this as a Christian, you know, but what happens when I step over into the civil or into the public realm? So for some Lutherans, they became otherworldly. So basically, you left the mandate to serve God in politics or your neighbor in politics, economics, culture. You left that alone. And you basically, my faith moved me in an otherworldly direction. Or some had a shallow this-worldly activism. And Dietrich Bonhoeffer, already in 1932, just before Hitler came to power, had a well-known talk. He wasn't very well received, mind you, on simply the Christian prayer, Thy Kingdom Come. What are Christians actually praying when they say, Thy Kingdom Come? And he would say, well, there is only one rule of God, but it comes in the function of preserving and in the function of creating new life. And new life is created predominantly through forgiveness, reintegrating people into community, and that is where the church has its function. But later on in his ethics, so the war was already coming on and was actually all there, then he was sitting in the monastery in Ettal for a while, and important little part of this, his ethics, which is not a book, right? He just had many drafts and he failed. Every time he tried to write an ethics, it didn't work. And then his student and friend and, Eberhard Bethge put it together and published it posthumously. But, so, read it as it is, with lightness of touch. But a section which is called Overcoming Two-Sphere Thinking, I think is a crucial one for our topic. So he claims that on the one hand, there's a pseudo-Lutheran scheme which gives an autonomy to the orders of the world. And then it leads to a submission to the status quo, and it led to the creation of German Christians. So a lot of Lutherans became, quote, German Christians, which accepted Nazi ideology. Right? So this version of submission can be very, very dangerous. And if you can give me a five at some point, David, when we're at that stage. The other version was the enthusiasts, that's Luther's language, but it's basically we're the chosen ones by God in some shape or form, and we have to take on the struggle against that hostile world and impose our order. So he says the result is a division of the world into sacred and profane. And this creates the possibility of existence that in only one or the other of the spheres, where the spiritual existence has no part of the secular existence, and a secular existence which can claim autonomy for itself and can exercise this right of autonomy in its dealings with the spiritual sphere. Sorry. Good. So, for Bonhoeffer, the key thing is there are not two realities, I'm quoting here, but only one reality, and that is the reality of God, which has become manifest in Christ in the reality of the world. So the result is worldliness does not divide a person from Christ,
And Christianity does not divide a person from the world. And
could you repeat that, please?
Sure. Worldliness does not divide a person from Christ. And Christianity does not divide a person from the world. We're totally in this earthly world. So when Luther then had his sabbatical, so he joined Nursi and everybody else, although his prison term was shorter, but of course it did end in execution. But he treated it like a sabbatical. It's a good time to sit and reflect. It's published as Letters and Papers from Prison, in the English translation, that is. And this is how he reflects on what does it mean to live in a single created reality, which is fallen, like humans are sinful, they're not living by trust or love, and also a world that is redeemed, ultimately a world that is reconciled to God, not rejected by God. So I'll quote this at length, and let's be close to the end. The I is Bonhoeffer. Later I discovered, and am still discovering up to this very moment, that it is only by living completely in this world that one learns to believe. Interesting, right? So even learning to believe can only happen when you're totally involved in the world. One must abandon every attempt to make something of oneself, whether it be a saint, a converted sinner, a churchman, a righteous man, or an unrighteous one, a sick man or a healthy one. This is what I mean by worldliness. Taking life in one's stride with all its duties and problems, its successes and failures, its experiences and helplessness, it is in such a life that we throw ourselves utterly into the arm of God and participate in his sufferings in the world and watch with Christ in Gethsemane. That is faith, that is metanoia, meaning repentance, and that is what makes a person and a Christian. How can success make us arrogant or failure lead us astray when we participate in the suffering of God by living in this world? So for Bonhoeffer, then, the reality of Christ means God is present within human history, within human life, and in all the complexity of what humans are about. At the same time, Christ gives a particular direction to be there for others. He calls him as the paradigmatic person for others. And so, therefore, Bonhoeffer found his time when he worked for the equivalent of the German CIA, the Abwehr, where he had very, if you want, secular tasks, right? He was smuggling basically money. They had a little money laundry operation, running money from Germany through Italy to help Jews that they had smuggled out via Switzerland, right? And that's where he was caught ultimately in that operation. And he didn't travel with the Bible. He couldn't at the time. And he felt totally engaging yourself in whatever the daily activities were is where he was practicing his faith. And as he sees sitting in Berlin falling down around him, right? I mean, a lot of you have seen the bombed out. I mean, you've seen many bombed out cities, but Berlin, of course, was very, very little left standing, but he was still sitting in the prison there. So everything is crumbling around you, and he just, well, what's our role? Well, ultimately, it's only the powerlessness of love for others that can ever save the world. That's all that's ever done it. We do not seek political power, but that doesn't mean we don't resist and try to shape that the governments do their proper role, right? But we're not seeking political powers. We are willing to suffer with, that's his phrase, we're trying to suffer with God in the midst of the complexity of whatever life offers to us. And I'll stop there.